A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. So glad you're with me on the program today. We're going to be talking with Chuck Lovelace, who is a gun shop owner in Wisconsin, and was featured in John Diedrich's series that we spoke with John about, ran in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Behind the Gun, which was, I thought, a rare example of a journalist, you know, delving into a gun issue without automatically blaming guns or gun owners. This was, I thought, a very fair series. And one of the things that John spoke about were the grassroots efforts, particularly in Wisconsin, on behalf of gun owners and those in the Second Amendment community to address suicide. So Chuck is part of something called the Gunshop Project in Wisconsin, where just like with Hold My Guns, folks can come in, say, hey, listen, I need to temporarily remove my firearms from my house for a little bit. Can you help? And Chuck says, why, yes, yes, we can. The goal is primarily to help those who are in crisis. Maybe it's not you, maybe it's somebody in your home, but you know, you don't feel comfortable having the firearms around for the moment, but you don't want to get rid of your guns entirely. You don't want to give up your collection. You certainly don't want to give up your Second Amendment rights. This is a way for, as Sarah Joy Albrecht with Hold My Gun says, for gun owners to retain agency, right? They're not being red flagged. There's no law enforcement involvement. There's no law involved. This is simply a matter of the Second Amendment community reaching out and being open to helping those in need. And Chuck has done this along with several dozen gun shops in Wisconsin. Hold My Guns, as we've talked about before, has, I believe, 9 FFLs working with them, and they are growing by leaps and bounds. In fact, they've got an online auction going on. Cheryl Todd is hosting this online auction to raise money for Hold My Guns. We'll provide a link for you in the comments here below, as well as at bearingarms.com. But on today's program, we're talking with Chuck about why he decided to take part in this program, what it involves on the part of an FFL, and why he feels that more FFLs should be doing this. Again, this isn't something that takes a lot of time, doesn't take a lot of money, although there can be some expenditures. But it provides the opportunity to, again, really help those who are in need without new legislation, without more gun control laws coming on the books, which is exactly what we want as a Second Amendment supporting community, right? So without any further ado, take a look and a listen to our conversation with Chuck Lovelace, here in Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. Chuck, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's so good to see you today, sir.
Thank you for having me. It's always an important topic, and I really enjoy sharing.
Yeah, and so I want to start just by asking, like, how and why did you decide that you wanted to be able to help folks out if they needed to be able to temporarily store their firearms? What made you decide, you know, I'm going to take this on myself?
You know, there's really no, I guess, defining moment. I mean, I joined the military when I was 17. I've always wanted to help people. And it was a natural progression, another way to be able to reach out and help people. And a lot of people have been touched by suicide. And so having programs and opportunities out there for people to have alternative ways to, you know, limit access to means during a time of crisis is really important and crucial in combating what is becoming the epidemic of suicide.
Absolutely. And, you know, to be able to do this voluntarily, right, to leave the power in the hands of the gun owner, as opposed to this, you know, top down mechanism of, well, you know, if somebody believes that you're a threat or a danger, we're going to red flag you. You know, I'm concerned. I have a lot of concerns about red flag laws, both from due process perspectives, but from a mental health perspective, you know, no red flag law that I'm aware of really offers any sort of mental health component to it whatsoever. The idea is, well, if we take the guns away, the problem is solved. From my perspective, if you're dealing with somebody who is struggling, then the most important thing to do is to make sure that, A, they're here to get the help that they need, but B, to make sure that they get that help. And so to me, you know, efforts like this, I think are a much better approach than saying we're going to take somebody's guns away and consider the problem fixed.
Well, and you know, when we first started this program, I mean, initially we started, I was working with one of the more liberal programs in Dane County, which if you're not familiar with the politics of Wisconsin, Dane County is the seat of the Capitol, and it's about as liberal as you get. So when you consider, I was approached by an organization called Safe Communities of Dane County. And I was approached because a police officer friend of mine that I grew up with happened to meet their suicide prevention coordinator. And she had this idea to incorporate the Gun Shop Project, which was an education tool for retailers to educate themselves and their employees on the signs of somebody who may be in a potential suicidal crisis and be able to redirect and or provide them information for getting help versus, you know, potentially completing a sale. And they approached me and asked me about it, if I wanted to, you know, help pioneer this and champion it in Dane County. And I jumped on board immediately because, you know, one, I knew I wasn't going to make any money from it. And as a small business owner, obviously at times that can be a consideration, is this going to make me money? Is it going to cost me money? Is it, you know, what's it going to do to my bottom line here? But the most important part to me was it was offering education to store owners and their employees, saying, here are the things you can look for. Because within a few months prior to that, we had had a gentleman come in, purchase a firearm, and he got delayed, came back, picked the firearm up. And 2 days later, we had Dane County deputies and detectives knocking at the door saying, did you sell this person this firearm? And were you aware they were going to use it to complete suicide? And that was rough. And that hit us hard. I mean, my wife was the one who had actually made the sale, and it hit her very hard. And so having this program where we could start talking about the signs was really the starting point for it. And fast forward 6 months, and we show up to a luncheon for Safe Communities, and that's where they announced that we were receiving the Program of the Year award from their yearly awards ceremonies, which is kind of cool when you consider a gun shop in one of the most liberal counties in the Midwest is getting an award from this organization. It's kind of unprecedented. And as I was sitting there with their suicide prevention coordinator, I said, you know, there's got to be more we can do. And she looked at me, she goes, well, what do you mean? I'm like, well, great. We've talked and educated the retailers, and we've educated the, you know, salespersons, but what can we do to help someone who might be in a crisis? And we literally wrote down the concept for the Safe Storage Initiative. The VA calls it the Live Today, Put It Away program. But it's literally the same concept. I mean, they based it off of the program that we sat down and wrote out on a cocktail napkin at a luncheon. And the premise of it was, let's provide a place that doesn't have law enforcement involvement. It doesn't have, you know, any kind of mental health care professional involvement. It's just a place for someone to bring their firearms when they're in a time of crisis, or a family member or friend is in a time of crisis, and they need a location to store a firearm while they get the help they need. And when that program kind of came to us, we were like, well, that's really cool. How are we going to do it though? Because, I mean, when you own a gun shop, the average gun safe takes up about 4 square feet, 5 square feet of floor space. That's a lot of, you know, a lot of sales space, so to speak, or storage space. And so you're giving up that space essentially for no payback. Right. And so that was a little hard for some people to kind of wrap their heads around. I mean, when we first started talking about the Gun Shop Project, you know, I signed a letter and it was sent out to every firearms retailer in Dane County saying, hey, we're going to start incorporating this Gun Shop Project. You know, we'd like you to help participate in it. And I was getting phone calls. Hey, what is this about? Is this a gun control thing? Is this a... And then I come up with the great idea of, let's take somebody who's in a time of crisis and give them a place to store their firearms where there's no judgment. There's no questions asked. Excuse me. There's no questions asked. And we just want to offer them a place to be able to store those firearms until they're out of that time of crisis. And then everybody says, well, that sounds a lot like gun control. Like, no, it has nothing to do with gun control. It has to do with limiting access to the means.
Right. And that, and I mean, I think understandably, you know, some folks immediately start thinking, okay, what are the drawbacks here, right? What are the unforeseen consequences? What are the hidden agendas involved? But as you say, there is no law enforcement component to this, and there is no direct mental health component to this. This is between the gun owner and the gun store owner, right? So walk me through this. I walk into your shop and I say, you know, Mr. Loveless, I've got some firearms that, you know, I need to store temporarily for a little bit of time. Can you help me with that? Is that generally how this starts?
Normally, yes. When people come in, we ask them to bring a trusted family member or friend with them.
Okay.
Just because we don't know where they are right then in their mental state. We're not judging them for where they are, but we also want to make sure that we keep ourselves and our staff safe. And we live in the shop that we own. So, you know, we're attached, our house is attached to the shop. And so for us, it's also a matter of security. But somebody calls me at 2 a.m. and says, hey, I've got a friend in a time of crisis, or hey, I'm in a time of crisis. I would like to drop these off. Yeah, sure. Bring them down and we'll take care of them. And, you know, the reason we ask them to bring a trusted family member or a friend is so that there's a third party involved, so that, you know, we're not left saying, you know, we took these in as a community service and they're saying, well, no, they took my guns from me. We want to make sure that, you know, the retailer is covered as well. But what happens is they come in, we fill out a simple contract, basically saying, hey, this is who you are. This is what you're going to store with us. And we're going to contact you in, you know, 90 days if we haven't heard from you by then to see where you're at. And if we need to extend it out for another 90 days, we can do that. If it reaches a point where we've had to extend it out, you know, an additional 90 days and they're still not quite sure where they should be at, you know, then we start to help them find alternative options if, you know, they're not comfortable having them back in custody or in the home, you know, whether those options are, let's find a family member who will, you know, take responsibility for them. Let's find, you know, an alternative. Maybe part of their crisis is financially, you know, tied together. So, okay, let's, you know, work with you to possibly sell these so that you can get some financial relief, you know, different opportunities there for them, but making sure that they understand that while there's no set time limit on how long the program goes. Mm-hmm. We do want to encourage them to actively pursue the help that they need and, you know, work in that 3 month, 6 month, 9 month time frame, you know, and by giving them that opportunity, it gives them a goal as well.
So what happens if somebody comes back, you know, 14 days later and says, you know, listen, the person who is staying with me is now, you know, getting treatment. They're, you know, in a better place. I feel comfortable getting my guns back. How do folks get their guns back from you?
They come in and they pick them up.
That's it.
That's it. You know, and when we log the guns in,
yeah,
we have special tags made up for them that are basically reminiscent of a dog tag.
Okay.
The dog tag has a cable on it and it's marked with ESS safe storage and it'll have a serial number, 1 through whatever. You know, if they bring in 10 firearms, it'll be 1 through 10. And when we add their information to our log books, we log them in as if we were doing gunsmithing for them.
Gotcha. Okay.
And by doing that, it's giving them the anonymity of the program, because if somebody were to open up that safe, they're not going to see a gunsmithing tag hanging on there. They're just going to see a silver tag with a serial number on it. And the corresponding entry into the gun log, you know, corresponds to that tag number. And so it gives them that a little bit of extra anonymity where you don't have someone who comes in and opens up the safe and looks at it and says, oh, what's John Doe doing here with his stuff? You know, why does he have 9 guns here? Well, that's none of your business.
So, you know, you talked about the initial skepticism that you heard from some FFLs. John Diedrich's reporting, we spoke with John, I think, back in December about his series. What kind of reaction have you received since you and your efforts have gotten some pretty high profile publicity in the state?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's amazing the positive feedback we've gotten.
From gun owners.
Oh, yes. From gun owners and non-gun owners. We've received phone calls. Just out of the blue, we'll get a phone call. Hey, I saw your information on the Gun Shop Project and safe storage, and we just want to thank you for what you're doing. And we had a good old fashioned thank you card sent to us by what the writing appears that you might have been an older lady. You know, and it was that beautiful cursive that older women have. And, you know, it said, you know, I'm not a gun owner, but I think what you're doing is really important and I want to thank you. I mean, there is no way to describe the sense of gratitude that you feel when you hear that kind of response. You know, in a world where everybody's quick to find the scheme or the gimmick,
right?
People just saying thank you for a simple service is amazing.
So what would you say, you know, what are the challenges for FFLs who want to be a part of this? I mean, you talked about finding the space, right? And giving up some of that footprint for something you're not going to make any money on. You know, is this something that you think most FFLs could do? Is this something that, you know, you have to do a little bit of planning to be able to take on something like this?
So is it something that all FFLs can do? Absolutely it is. Because in the end, you can limit the number of firearms you take in for storage. You can limit, you know, the number of individuals that you're willing to help. I don't know why you would, but you can. So, you know, it's really on the FFL as far as how deeply they want to become involved in the program. I have a 48 gun fire resistant safe. That safe takes up about a 2-foot by 3-foot footprint. Is that a big footprint? In the grand scheme of things, no. If that footprint saves one life, is it worth the investment of the, you know, if you want to break it down into square footage, you know, is it worth the investment of $14 a month in rent or mortgage payment? Absolutely. It's worth it just because, you know, it's saving a life. It's helping, you know, give someone a little bit of a timeout and a break to be able to get things back on track so that, you know, they can live a happy and healthy life and you can sleep a little bit better. You know, the Gun Shop Project, when we first started it, the idea of denying a sale to someone because they may be acting a certain way, for small gun shop owners, that's kind of a scary thought because, you know, with a small town gun shop, you may only have 2 or 3 sales in a day. So if you're turning down a gun sale, that could be your gun sale of the day or your second sale of the day. You know, that's really giving you a hard, you know, look at the program and saying, is this something I can afford to do for my family? And realize that, you know, yeah, there's going to be nights where you're going to eat ramen noodles instead of steak, but it's worth it. You know, it's worth it to have that extra, you know, time and have that extra, you know, input in someone's life that hopefully gets them back on track and gets them being a productive member of society and a happy person and a responsible gun owner again. Not saying that someone in a crisis is an irresponsible gun owner, but giving them the opportunity to go out and enjoy their firearms in a safe and healthy manner.
Absolutely. And that is what it's about, right? It's about being there to help be that bridge from that time of crisis to, again, addressing those issues, dealing with those issues and finding yourself on firmer footing again, right? That's, I think, the end goal for everybody involved here. And, you know, I love the fact that, gun owners are not leaving this up to gun control activists. We're not leaving it up to the state, we're not leaving it up to the government to come down with these, solutions that often aren't solutions at all. I guess some folks may want to say, well, don't talk about this, right? This is inconvenient. This is embarrassing. Gun control advocates can use this to say, well, look, this is why we need red flag laws and safe storage mandates and all this other stuff. We can argue about the policies, but I don't think that there is any argument that whether you're a gun owner or not, we have a responsibility to help those in need. We have a responsibility to help those in crisis. And this is something, again, that I think is, we talked with Sarah Joy Albrecht from Hold My Guns, which is, again, almost an identical program. She talks about the personal empowerment aspect of this, that you're still giving gun owners, you're not taking their agency away from them, right? They're still right. The ones in control. They're still the ones in charge of their life, which I do think is very important because, again, it's not just about if you're dealing with, if we're talking about somebody who's in the midst of a crisis. Yes, being able to temporarily store those firearms somewhere safely, I think is important. But again, it's also up to them, as you say, to go and get the help that they need, whether that is through, formal mental health counseling or another avenue. But when you have the state coming down on you, right, it's really easy to get your back up. It's really easy to all of a sudden say, well, I'm not going to do what you want me to do because it's about you telling me what to do as opposed to me deciding for myself what needs to be done. So yes. I think that is such a crucially important aspect of what you're doing. And it sounds like, again, it really is paying off.
I looked at it from this standpoint. My initial investment, my wholesale cost on the safe that I bought, I got it on sale for like $750. If $750 saves a life, it's the best $750 I've ever spent. We've all been touched in some way by suicide. I've had friends, veteran friends and civilian friends and family members that have committed suicide over the years. And so giving people an opportunity to just take that step back and take a breath, one more breath, if that's their mantra that gets them through, and then they can come back and say, hey, I'm ready to pick up my firearms. That's great. That's amazing. And if they come back and say, hey, I'm not comfortable taking them back. Well, okay, we're going to help you get as much money as we possibly can out of them for you.
Yeah. Well, listen, Chuck, I can't thank you enough for sitting down with me today and sharing some of your story. I'd love to have you back at some point in the future, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
Excellent. I really appreciate it. Thank you for everything you're doing. If folks want more information, again, I mentioned Hold My Guns, but obviously there are a number of other programs out there, including the Safe Storage Initiative in Wisconsin. How can folks in Wisconsin learn more about the program there in your state?
So one of the easiest ways to do it is just to Google Gun Shop Project, and a plethora of articles and information will pop up. I believe the number one placer is John Dietrich's article from the Journal Sentinel. But also there's Be There Wisconsin. That is the Captain John D. Mason Suicide Prevention Program. And so that's Be There, BETHERE.WIS.com.
Okay.
They provide a plethora of information there, as well as an interactive map for all 40 gun shops that are in the state that are participating in this program.
That is fantastic. That is fantastic. Chuck Lovelace, thank you again for everything you're doing. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. And I look forward to reconnecting again in the future, man.
Thank you so much. I look forward to it.
My thanks to Chuck for joining me on the program, as well as for everything that he is doing there to help gun owners in need in Wisconsin. Right now, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a case out of Kentucky. A man charged in a shooting last May at a mall has already been released on probation. This is in Louisville, Kentucky. 22-year-old Trishawn Fowler Milan pleaded guilty last year to firing three shots inside the mall at a Lids store. Apparently, there was a confrontation. Fowler Milan pulled out a gun. One person was shot in the arm, had to undergo surgery at a local hospital. His original charges included assault and wanton endangerment. And again, after less than a year behind bars, he has now been released on probation. Judge Jennifer Bryant Wilcox granting that probation on Wednesday. Fowler Milan will be supervised by a parole officer for 5 years, according to the court. Additional terms of his probation include not possessing or having access to any firearms, random drug testing, no drugs or alcohol, substance abuse treatment, maintaining a full or a part-time job, or attending school full-time, as well as no contact with the victim in this case. Well, I hope that he abides by the terms of his probation. But again, you know, in Kentucky, we've seen no shortage of Democrats this year talking about the need for more gun control laws on the books, right? They want to put a red flag law in place. They want to put additional gun control measures. Maybe, and I'm just, you know, spitballing here, but maybe the answer lies in ensuring that there are actual consequences for committing a serious crime like this. Somebody was injured in this shooting, and yet, less than 12 months later, the guy who admitted to pulling the trigger is walking free. Doesn't sit right with me. Today's Armed Citizen story from Denver, Colorado. I might have mentioned this on an earlier edition of Cam and Company. I can't remember if I wrote about this or not, but there was a shooting at a construction site in Denver. Basically, the manager of that construction site was checking on the site, came across a couple of burglars, and fired shots. Now, prosecutors say that he will not face charges, but as you see in the headline, the one of the victim's fathers disagrees with that decision by prosecutors. I understand, you know, your child gets hurt in the commission of a crime. Maybe you want to blame the person who was acting in self-defense, but it does appear that this was a pretty clear-cut case of self-defense. The Denver DA's office sent a statement to Fox 31 in Denver saying, after considering all of the evidence in this case, including a 911 call, a statement from the shooter, and various pieces of physical evidence that corroborated the shooter's statement, we do not believe that we can prove any criminal charges to a jury beyond reasonable doubt. A major factor in that decision, which was supported by the Denver Police Department detective who investigated the case, was our belief that there is a significant claim of self-defense on the part of the shooter, who was approached by the alleged burglars and then sprayed in the face with bear spray. We also consider the fact that the shooter, a superintendent of the location where the shooting happened, was checking the building at the time of the shooting due to multiple recent burglaries. Robert McFall, whose daughter died in this shooting, said, well, they might have been trespassing, whatever they were doing. I can't say to that, but they didn't deserve to die, that's for sure. Here's the thing. In Colorado, using deadly force in defense of property is a crime. So if they had merely been trespassing, if they had merely been burglaring or engaged in a burglary, then McFall would be right. And the shooter in this case would likely be facing charges. But that's not what happened. Again, according to investigators, the situation started when the manager of this construction site showed up, found two people who weren't supposed to be there. He confronted them, and that's when they reportedly assaulted him, spraying him in the face with bear spray. Now, once you are blind and you can't see, you're obviously at a disadvantage, right? Lots of material around a construction site that could be used to harm or kill somebody. So by assaulting this man, he was in legitimate fear for his life, and he was justified in pulling out a firearm and shooting the pair. The man, 40-year-old Timothy Walker, died at the scene. The woman, 37-year-old Patricia McFall, or Patience McFall, rather, was taken to the hospital where she passed away. Her dad says he fired seven rounds, which is very excessive. He could have backed out the door and let the police do their job, and they'd both be alive today. If he had any remorse, could have provided some life-saving help to her. Well, again, I don't think that firing seven rounds is all that excessive when you're dealing with multiple assailants. Again, he had been sprayed in the face with bear spray, so he might not have been able to provide aid or assistance to his assailants after they assaulted him. Again, I understand this father's grief. I do. But it doesn't change the circumstances of his daughter's death. If the construction manager was in legitimate fear for his life, and it sounds like he was, based on the actions of his assailants, he had every right to use deadly force against people who had no right to be in that construction site, and no right whatsoever to assault someone when they were discovered. Now, on to today's good deed of the day from New Jersey, where neighbors helped to save a couple who were trapped in their burning home. You can see on the Ring doorbell footage there, the blaze on the right side of your screen. This was in West Deptford, New Jersey. Jim Miller said he jumped out of bed and ran across the street early Saturday morning when he heard his daughter scream that their neighbor's home was engulfed in flames. And he was one of the first neighbors to arrive there. So the whole front of the house was just a ball of flame. He said, "We started banging on the basement window, and we broke it out, and all of a sudden we heard a woman's voice, 'We're here, we're here.' And I'm going, 'Where? Where are you? Where are you at?' Miller says another neighbor ran over to help at the same time. They were able to push their way through bushes to get to the back of the home. That's where they found the woman just outside the basement door screaming, but her husband was still inside. He had been overcome by smoke at that point. Miller says, so me and Joe, the other neighbor, grabbed him. We drug him up, got him onto the backyard, and I started rubbing his chest. Another neighbor, Tom Carey, woke up to his dog barking. He could see the glow of the fire from his window. So he said he jumped over a small fence, started yelling for his next door neighbors to get out. He said, I went to the back door, started banging on the doors, banging on the windows, literally anything to make noise. The couple taken to a local hospital. They suffered minor burns and smoke inhalation, but they are going to recover. Tom Carey says, I'm just happy that they're safe. Took firefighters more than 90 minutes to get the blaze under control. The home likely a total loss. But the neighbors say that they will have their friends' backs when they get out of the hospital again in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Jim Miller, Tom Carey, Joe, the neighbor, don't have a last name, but all of these individuals in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing to help their neighbors in need. And for that, we give you our sincere thanks for a very good deed indeed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking with the folks from the Gun Owners Action League about the process in which this gun control bill that's currently in a conference committee has taken shape, and more specifically, the abuse of process that has taken place in trying to ram this gun control law bill into law. Again, we'll talk with Jim Wallace, Mike Harris, the folks from Goal tomorrow on Cam & Company. In the meantime, be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day. We're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. If you like what you see, I'd encourage you to become a VIP or VIP Gold member as well. Just use the promo code SAVEAMERICA for a substantial discount on your VIP or VIP Gold membership. As our way of saying thanks for showing your support, we're going to give you exclusive content you won't find anywhere else. User support really does matter, and it truly does make a difference. So thank you again. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Till then, be well, be safe, and be free.